500 years of Reformation. So, what's not to like?
The damage is on the social order because it disconnects everything. It turns laws into contracts. It undoes the idea that our relationships of promise should be respected because everything now has to be formalized. It disenchants the whole social, economic, and political realm.
And there's more where that came from. For John Milbank, modern ills can be traced back to heretical ideas made prominent by Martin Luther and John Calvin. Those ills include the decline of the universities, the rise of managerial politics, and the destruction of ways of knowing that could counter today's obsessions. Oh, and there's Brexit too. But it's not all bad news. John Milbank is Emeritus Professor of Politics, Religion and Ethics at the University of Nottingham, and he's with Scott Stevens in the Philosopher's Zone.
John Milbank, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thank you.
So the 500th anniversary of the European Reformation falls in a rather unusual year. To what extent is Brexit an extension of the logic of the Reformation itself?
Well, I think very much so. Curiously, Martin Kettle in The Guardian wrote a good article about that, you know, suggesting that the English hardly know now who Martin Luther was, and yet the Protestant legacy of a kind of island exceptionalism, the idea we are superior and different, survives very strongly and possibly in a secular form is more dangerous, and I think did help to drive the Brexit vote. Yes, the sense of a suspicion of the continent that it's supposed to be authoritarian, legalistic, alien. Yeah, I think it's a factor.
You say that for most Britons, they wouldn't actually have a clear sense of who Martin Luther was. I do just wonder, what sense is there when the term Reformation is evoked? What does that tend to evoke, even simply at a popular level?
Do you know, I'm no longer entirely sure. I think a huge number of British people now would have no idea whatsoever what it meant, and that insofar as they do think about religion, they think in terms of persecutions and horrors. There's a show on at the moment, the Gunpowder Plot, and it seems to put excessive focus on those moments, you know, of torture and execution and so on. And otherwise, I think maybe with people who are a little more educated, it's seen as something like the beginning of religious liberty, a movement towards a privatization of spirituality, a harbinger of the Enlightenment, those kind of things, and is broadly seen as leading towards the progressive. I mean, this is much stronger, you know, in Germany. In the case of Britain, you know, Luther had little influence anyway. Calvin had a great deal more influence. But it was, this is a truism, but it was primarily and from the outset a political reformation, you know, an act of national independence. And theologically, the English at least, you know, maybe not the Scots so much, but the English were very confused about the theology and very quickly came out with very mixed kinds of theology. So you've got the strange situation where there's this tradition of a Protestant island, and yet in some ways we're not that obviously Protestant at all. And Protestantism for us seems to mean a very political project.
So, John, why don't you just set the record straight? How would you characterize the Reformation? What do we mean by that?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily difficult. I think the first thing to be aware of is that the Middle Ages was endlessly aware of the fact that the church needed reform, that there was too much corruption, that the laity weren't Christian enough. So there were endless reforming efforts, and some of them were deemed heretical. Some of them were incorporated into the mainstream. And when it comes to the Reformation itself, I think it's almost, in a way, accidental that the big people you talk about emerged as the heroes. I think there were a whole multitude of reforming movements. I think, though, that the reason why Luther and Calvin are favored is that secular authorities see their way of looking at things as offering a chance of a big power grab, you know, because basically their suspicion of all human works and the idea that somehow human works are not connected to our salvation or to the supernatural, in effect, sort of secularizes a whole sphere, the political sphere, the economic sphere, even the social sphere, and allows that to be handed over to secular forces and even to a large degree to be de-ethicized. So I think that those Protestant currents quite quickly start to fuse with brands of very cynical tacity and humanism that stress reason of state and so on, encouraging essentially an amoral approach to, I know this is a simplification, but I don't think it's untrue, an amoral approach to politics and economics that's very much underwritten by this idea that our works are irrelevant to our salvation. And what is really interesting is that, you know, currents of the more radical Reformation, of which there were several, are almost the opposite, that they are stressing the importance of works and of changing and so on. But, I mean, there's a sense in which I would enunciate the paradox that the Reformation is actually the despair of reform. You know, it's saying we're just going to rely on God's mysterious election. We can't change anything. We can't reform at all. You know, at least that's one side. I'd like a bit later to qualify that picture.
Well, see, this is very interesting to me. I realize that I run the risk of simplifying greatly here, but it's always struck me that the very pessimistic understanding, both of human nature, but also of the inefficacy, the kind of perpetually tainted nature of human action itself, that lends itself, doesn't it, to a kind of Hobbesian vision of the nature of political orders.
Oh, completely, yes. This is why I have real problems about seeing Luther and Calvin as genuinely Christian thinkers. Luther said the most extreme things. For example, he says when he's younger and when he's supposed to be nicer, he says that, you know, everything that God does appears to be evil, but is really good. Everything we do appears to be good, but is really evil. And this is a kind of Manichaeanism, you know, linked to a kind of indiscernibility, you know, that the real good is completely unknown and completely inscrutable. And it means that there is just no relationship towards what we think of as good and what is genuinely good. So this runs the danger of licensing everything and anything. And the doctrine of total depravity is just not compatible with a Christian outlook at all, because it's certainly not compatible with an Augustinian outlook that Luther is in reality perverting. Because if everything is deep down good, every being as such is deep down good and can only be perverted, and evil is only a kind of privation, it's not a kind of force in itself, then you can never say that human nature is totally depraved. As long as human beings exist, the impulse to the good can be contaminated, but it can't be wiped out. And I think this is far nearer to a kind of heretical Manichaeanism than actually most commentators are really prepared to admit. And absolutely, it paves the way for Hobbes, that what Hobbes is offering is a way in which politics can work in a totally depraved world. And he's very explicit about that. And unlike later liberals, Hobbes knows that what he's offering is anti-Christian. You know, on the cover, Leviathan is Antichrist, and Hobbes knows that. It is the reign of Antichrist. But he thinks, for now, we can only be in the reign of Antichrist, so that, I mean, Giorgio Agamben is really good on this, so that at the end of time, indeed, there will be divine rule will break in. But for now, we're totally in the grip of evil, if you like, and it becomes a matter of how do you manage or temper evil? And you can only do that by, you know, a system of contract, of agreeing out of fear. We agree not to harm each other in order to feel safer.
Now, one of the great effects of the Reformation that I think often goes overlooked or at least undiagnosed is the notion of fragmentation. That if a theology of participation lends itself to an integrated, unified, understanding of knowledge, understanding of political orders, understanding of the integrated nature of social life, the interconnectedness of human beings. It seems to me that this idea that the Reformation initiated a kind of fragmentation, a fracture across the texture of human political epistemic life, that it seems to me to be far-reaching indeed.
I think this is exactly right. I think it's a kind of disconnection. And it's very important to say or to reiterate that I don't think this just began with the Reformation. I think it begins with late medieval thought, with Duns Scotus, and then even more with nominalism, you know, with the doctrine that there only exist individual items and there are no real universals or relations. So if one person takes an action, it doesn't affect everybody else. It doesn't sort of communicate itself through an alteration of human nature in that person. So you could only think of the alteration of individuals, not what happens between individuals. And of course, even thinking about something like motion becomes very difficult in this context, because motion is inherently something that happens between things. It's an intermediary stage. It's halfway between potential and action and so on. That's one reason why Protestantism also encourages very mechanical notions of motion, which really get rid of the idea of motion, because it means you can chop up a motion into a series of beginnings and endings so that motion doesn't really exist anymore. But it's very important to say that all this happens on the Catholic side as well as the Protestant side. You know, there are currents within Counter-Reformation thought that are almost equally culpable, because, you know, the loss of the participatory vision precedes Protestantism. And above all, and I haven't mentioned this so far, I think what it leads to is a kind of idealization of God, whereby you're not thinking of the idea that God is absolutely transcendent. God is being itself. God is everything, if you like. He's not another particular item. But with the loss of participation, you start to think of God as an individual, as another item. And therefore, you start to think that the more God acts, the less other things are acting, as if everything was on the same plane. And this disconnects God from us, because it means that either God is completely overruling us, which tends to be what Luther and Calvin says, or we're engaged in this kind of bargaining with God, which Protestantism also retains, because there is no inherent connection any longer between creatures and God, between human beings and God. So the biggest disconnection is between human beings and God. And that leads to a very odd situation whereby the despair of the moral order means either you're saying, well, God rules everything economically, and you get this idea eventually of the hidden hand and so on, and of the way there's a kind of economic order that works amorally by appealing to our worst instincts, or you get this kind of extreme human constructionism in political thinking, where you think of the political order as non-organic but entirely artificial, because we have to artificially reconnect things, because nothing is inherently connected with each other, with other things at all.
John Milbank, theologian and political philosopher, on the Reformation 500 years on, the good, the bad, and the ugly. He's with Scott Stevens, editor of ABC Religion and Ethics Online.
There's no institution, though, that this fragmentation has had a greater effect on, it seems to me, than the university.
Yeah. Before I answer that, I just want to register the qualifier. And the qualifier is that the legacy of the Radical Reformation, and also the legacy of a different element in Luther, which insists that the Christian life can be fully lived by anybody in any vocation, in a way points in a bizarrely opposite direction.
Yes.
So if I'm saying that on the whole, Protestantism is very dualistic and it secularizes, there is also a conflicting opposite tendency of almost making the ordinary sacred more than Catholicism had done. And I think what you see in later Protestant history is that sometimes that means they can recover, and often in a more radical way, this participatory vision I'm talking about. Mm. So, you know, if we look at the metaphysical poets, we look at the romantic poets, German romanticism, there's always this countercurrent operating in Protestantism. And it would be totally unfair to the tradition not to mention that. And that indeed affects the realm of knowledge as well. So
let me just press you one step further on that point.
Yeah.
Because one of the more remarkable insights, I think, that you've made is what that then does about the nature of charity yeah. itself within a Protestant frame.
So on one level, you can say Protestants are downgrading works. But on another level, you could also say they're insisting that works should be done not to earn salvation, but simply because they are good. So in a sense, in keeping with the original creative act of God's goodness, it's a kind of overflowing charity that you do precisely for its own sake. And I think this is very important when we come to look at the history of Protestantism. It seems to have had two opposite consequences. On the one hand, there is this sort of leeching away of the moral from the economic and the political order. And I think people like Weber were not ultimately wrong about that. But on the other hand, there is also this strong Protestant impulse towards, you know, charitable giving, social service, you know, an ethic of public commitment that you see in all northern countries, if you like, that points in an opposite direction. And I think it's also true that the Calvinist tradition, because it's more about trying to recover an Old Testament order, has sometimes put forward political solutions much more like those of Catholicism, much more about real achievement of political virtue, distribution of power. So I really want to say these things because I'm not condemning a whole tradition. I think there are these almost opposite tendencies.
And when you say an almost opposite tendencies, they are almost opposite because of what a deficient understanding of metaphysics?
In the end. But I think often Protestants have found their way back to a more adequate understanding of metaphysics that allows for the reality of universals, relations, participation, and so on. And so, yes, I think it does come down to the way that the reformers initially tried to sideline metaphysics, almost tried to do without it. And then later on, we found we can't do that. But I mean, that certainly has implications, I think, for the whole organization of knowledge and the university life. Because if you don't recover that metaphysical unity, that sort of unity of traditions of wisdom that unite philosophy and theology, and indeed metaphysics, physics, logic, and so on, broadly speaking, the whole Neoplatonic legacy. And because that remains marginal, I think we do run into problems. And I think, above all, there's this tension between sola scriptura, the idea that the Bible is completely authoritative and speaks in a literal voice. I mean, it's very hard to read the Bible that way without sort of looking for these absolutely literal and definite divine decrees, or in practice, handing over the reading of the Bible to a new priestly caste, which are, you know, the ministers and the church hierarchy and so on. Now, if you don't have that, as you've indicated, you have, and as Brad Gregory has rightly said, you have complete anarchy, you know, a complete anarchy of opinion and choice. And that may seem absolutely fabulous. But I think, as another writer, James Simpson, has said, instead what you get is a new sort of a more insidious ideational authority. It's what we now call political correctness, really. That political correctness is only the extreme form of this covert, latent, ideational authority, which is trying to discipline anarchy by imposing formal norms about what it's allowable to say and to think. And above all, this is about not interfering with other people's liberty of choice. And if you think about it, almost anything can be interpreted as interfering with other people's liberty of choice or causing them offence. This is what our students now tend to think catastrophically in universities. And so ultimately, you get a much more insidious form of authoritarianism because you have to exercise formal control in terms of doctrines of human rights run absolutely riot. You know, so we can only agree about a situation in which freedom of choice is absolutely guaranteed by a system, and that's combined with the search for utilitarian efficiency on which supposedly we could all agree because it's objective. And what we've removed from that is any sense that we're pursuing substantive goals. And the pursuit of substantive goals is linked to something like an unfolding tradition, a shared ethical consensus, a feel for things to which people can contribute creatively. And in reality, that's far less authoritarian, but it would take a lot of persuading people now because everybody sees it the other way around.
I mean, what you've just described, we wouldn't even have to go back to the high Middle Ages to find a vision of university life that would resonate with that vision. I mean, even in John Stuart Mill's vision of the university,
I agree,
there is a presumption that it's in the university itself that that more fundamental form of social organization is going to be exemplified and ultimately formed.
I completely agree, and that's because Mill has read Coleridge. And I think the trouble is we think, people are appealing back to the Middle Ages and that's absurd. But the point is we're talking about the slow death of the Middle Ages. You know, the Middle Ages and antiquity before it have left a huge legacy that's only gradually become diluted. And the university is a really good example of that. It's a corporation. It's like a guild. It's a self-ruling guild of academics. And even its very name, Universitas, if you think of Oakeshott, means that it's a universitas, not a societas. In other words, it's people coming together for a common substantive purpose, which is the pursuit of truth and goodness. And it's assumed that these things really exist, you know, even if there are disagreements about the account of them. So if you lose the sense that there is some sort of objective, even eternal truth and goodness, you can't any longer have a universitas, a university. It's become a societas, which is just a group of people contracting together to pursue their own interests. This is why today universities are just about helping people pursue their careers or, you know, helping technological processes and so on. This is why very rapidly and almost, I think, in my own experience, almost within the last 3 years, it's becoming questionable whether some universities in Britain really are universities at all. They're certainly not a guild of academics anymore. They're controlled by bureaucrats and administrators whose main purposes are functional and financial and think they are running a business. But ironically, to some degree, universities remain islands. So, you know, the old pursuit of metaphysics, study of Aristotle and Plato carries on, and it even creeps back and becomes more important within Protestant universities. So it's as if universities do remain medieval islands, that they're still about the pursuit of truth, how to live a good life in keeping with truth. But eventually things do go totally full circle. So a disease, you could argue, that was begun in the university becomes in the end to destroy the university. And I think that's what's happening now, that universities themselves have to conform to these automatic, impersonal, amoral procedures.
The legacy of the Reformation, from the universities to Brexit. John Milbank is Emeritus Professor of Politics, Religion and Ethics at the University of Nottingham. And he was with Scott Stevens, editor of ABC Religion and Ethics Online and co-host with Waleed Ali of The Minefield. And there's a lot more on the subject on our special page. Interviews, articles, audio and video. There's even one of Luther, sort of. Just head for the RN homepage and look for the tile, From Reformation to Revolution. Thanks today to Diane Dean and Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you next time in the Philosopher's Zone.